We're glad you're all here, especially if you're new or coming back. All panels and the main speaker meetings are being recorded and will be available for free online at www.askupala.org about a week after this conference. All full names or tradition breaks will be omitted. Please welcome our first speaker, who is going to be Ashley I.
My name's Ashley. I'm alcoholic.
Ashley.
Thank you for, you know, asking me to speak here today. I'm like nervous, but that'll pass. My sobriety date is April 27th, 2007. I knew I was going to draw a blank. Okay, so. You know, the topic tragedy and sobriety, I think of like when I first got sober. I had about a week sober and I found a sponsor, and the first time we were on the phone we had this conversation, and I asked, is there ever a reason to drink? And she laughed when I asked that question and then realized that I was serious, and she said, no. You know, there's never a reason to drink, and so I came up with like this crazy like hypothetical question, and I don't remember everything I said, but it was something like, well, what if my house burned down and someone stole my car and then my whole family died, and like came up with this like elaborate story, like would that be a good reason to drink? And she was like, no, like there's never a reason to drink. And she explained to me, you know, the reason I drank was because I liked the effect produced. And secretly, I kind of wanted something. The selfishness and the self-centeredness within me wanted something bad enough to happen to where it was okay for me to pick up a drink and no one could blame me. And it was okay. And about 30 days, when I had about 30 days sober around that time, something tragic did happen. My dad, who's also an alcoholic, he smoked crack for 4 days straight and decided to attempt suicide and drove his vehicle on the wrong side of the road, going 80 miles an hour on like a normal street, and 45 mile an hour wrong way, and caused a four-car collision, and two people almost died. They were in the hospital for about 2 weeks. When he didn't die, he punched his windshield out, took the glass from the windshield, started slitting his wrist because he was determined to die. And I remember I called my sponsor, and I was just terrified. I was like, I want to drink. Like, I want to drink over, like, I can't handle this. I can't deal with it, you know? And she went on to further explain, like, you know, she reiterated the, we drink because we like the effect produced. Like, I was never drinking because of a reason. And I didn't believe that. Even when she told me, like, I didn't fully believe it, because what I was thinking was, if you only knew the things I've gone through throughout my life, then you would understand that I had every reason in the world to drink. And so what happened for me was, you know, she went on to explain that my only chance was having a spiritual experience. And the way to go about that was to work the steps. And so to me, it was an emergency. Like, I had to do these things. And I trusted and believed in her because she was sober. You know, she had the experience of being sober, and you know, and I would come to meetings and I'd look around and I would hear like how other people used to drink and what their life used to be like, and that was me. Like, never did I experience prior to that, like coming into these rooms, being able to relate to anybody, you know, and then I would hear what they were like and see what they're like now. I'm like, wow, you don't resemble that person anymore. And so I gave complete faith into Alcoholics Anonymous. And so she told me, like, get in the middle of it, like, get a commitment, get a home group, you know, do these things. And so I did those things. And as a result of working the steps, I had a spiritual awakening that in the obsession to drink left. And, you know, the first about 2.5 years, I completely threw myself into this. Like, I got sober in Casa Grande, so it's really cool to, like, come back, you know, to where I got sober and, like, speak here, you know? And, like, you know, we started meetings, like, we started the young people's meeting, like, we didn't even know young people's existed, and, like, my sponsor came to speak at my home group, she announced it, and then we were, like, got this fire lit up under our butts, and we were like, yeah, like, we want, you know, we want young people and to know that they have a place to come. And so we did that, started a lot of meetings, sponsored women, you know, did all these things, and my quality of life was great. Like, and I felt so connected. And then throughout my sobriety, I mean, there was definitely trials that came about with my dad, you know? And one thing I kind of want to just, like, give a disclaimer on is my dad has a lot to do with, like, tragedy and sobriety for me, right? But I can't share his experience because it's not mine. Like, I can only share my experience through that and staying sober. And, you know, and I also can't scare anyone into staying sober and giving these, you know, horror stories about what happened with my dad because that doesn't carry depth or weight. But on October 26, 2009, my dad committed suicide. And my whole world shattered. I was at work that day, and the cops came in. I was his next of kin, so they came into my work, and they pulled me into the back room, and they said, like, are you Charles' daughter? And I said, he's dead, isn't he? And he said, yeah. And I said, what do I do? Like, there's three policemen and, like, a minister or pastor there, and they all came, and I just asked them, I'm like, what do I do? Like, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. Like, I'm the first person in my whole family that has this knowledge that my dad just died, you know, and where I was working at the time, right across the street, like, the parking lot within walking distance was the bar that I used to drink at daily and close it down every single night. And I'm like, and I tell the police officers, I'm like, I'm an alcoholic. Like, I am so afraid of what's going to happen once I walk out of this threshold, like, this door. I don't know what's going to happen. And so what I knew to do is I just called my sponsor. She was the first person I called. And she walked me through, like, the next step to do almost every hour, you know, because I was just a mess. And like, the first few months, there was a lot of shock and disbelief, and I didn't believe it. And it was very easy to, like, function almost like a robot. You know, I was able to wake up in the morning, go to work, and go to a meeting, and continue my meeting attendance and do these things. And I was in so much shock. But after that shock wore off, I, like, and over a period of time, I hit this, like, this emotional, spiritual bottom in sobriety that was almost as hard, if not harder, than when I first got sober. You know, I completely withdrew. I isolated a lot. I slept a lot. And I started to lose faith in everything I thought I knew, because what happened for me, like, when my dad died, you know, and taking his own life, too, which is really just a result of the disease. I questioned everything I thought I knew, and nothing made sense to me anymore. You know, and everything anyone could possibly say to me just made me angry. you know, and people tried the best they could. You know, they would say things like, nothing happens by mistake. Well, in my mind, I'm thinking, fuck that. Like, nothing happens by mistake. I don't give a shit. Like, I don't believe that. Like, my dad shouldn't have been able to, like, kill himself. You know what it, like, I was just so angry. And, you know, and what I had believed prior to that, you know, I believed in God. Because I, you know, all these spiritual beliefs that I had, they turned, they changed. And I started to question, like, everything. Like, what is the point? That's where I was at. Like, what's the point? If we all come here, if one day, every one of us in this room is going to die one day, then what's the point? Like, everything seems so pointless. And I felt very isolated and alone, and I saw no point in having relationships with other people. Because I was so highly resentful, I thought the solution to being resentful, like non-resentful, was to not have relationships. Because if I don't have people in my life, I can't become resentful. And it got to this really lonely, dark, dark spot. And what? And I became suicidal. And I didn't want to live, and I didn't want to deal with feeling anything anymore in sobriety. And either I was going to kill myself, or I had this great plan that kept coming up of like, oh, I'm going to sell all my personal belongings and go live in the woods in my car and just live off the land. Like I thought maybe that'll bring me some spiritual liberation. I don't know. But... and then the pain became so strong that I finally became willing, because it was going to be one of three things. Either I'm going to drink again, which is always a possibility if I'm not like doing the deal. Either I'm going to drink again, I'm going to kill myself, which I thought was more likely than drinking, just because I wouldn't want to have to go through like drinking and the shit that goes along with that, like, or I'm going to kill myself, or I'm going to dive right back in and get some kind of relief and feel like, you know. And so it's only been like the last 3 months that I've been doing things that I haven't been doing for a really long time. You know, I went without a home group for a year and a half. I didn't work steps because I wasn't willing for a really long time. I wasn't praying. I wasn't talking to people. So I've been doing those things again. And through that, I feel as if I am in the midst right now of a spiritual awakening. Because I surrendered. Because the pain became so strong. And I just am recently getting some peace with my dad dying. Because I really believed that I would never be okay ever again. And I feel okay. You know? I can see how God is working my life right now in ways that I never saw possible before. People are being presented in my life and telling me things that hit home directly, and not like in an indirect kind of broad way, but they're saying things and sharing experiences with me that there's nothing else that can possibly explain it other than like a power that's greater than me. And the fact that I was able to remain sober, like I fucked up a lot in the time that my dad died until recently. I'm fucking up a lot less. The one thing I did that entire time, like I through that I owe amends to people in my life that I hurt because I was afraid. But the one thing I did do that entire time was I continued to work the first step, because the minute I put anything into my body, like all bets are off. You know, and not only did it save my life, but it potentially probably saved someone else's. Because when I'm that destructive, like, who knows what could happen? And, that, that really dark spot I was in for a really long time, now that I'm starting to, you know, step out of that and being able to kind of look at it from a different perspective, I do believe through my experience that that was absolutely necessary for me to experience that, for my own spiritual growth and my own journey. And my, and you know, it doesn't have to be yours. Like, your experience within tragedy and sobriety, like, things are going to happen, you know, your experience can be completely different than mine, but for mine, like, it was absolutely necessary. Because I'm at a place right now where I'm willing to admit I might be wrong about everything I think I know. It's kind of like when I first came in and they said, like, you have to be open-minded. You have to be willing to let go of old ideas. And now I'm in a place yet again where it's like, I am willing to admit that these ideas I've come up with while being sober, I might be wrong. And I have to let go of these old prejudices and beliefs. And I'm just really grateful that I didn't have to die. And this program saved my life when I first came in, and it continues to save my life. So, with that, I'm going to pass.
Thank you. Thank you, Ashley. Our next speaker is going to be Victor T. All right, welcome, Victor, please.
My name is Victor. I'm an alcoholic. Yeah. I'd like to welcome anybody who's new to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd like to thank everybody who put on the conference for having me here. It's such a huge honor. Thank you. I'm going to tell you a little bit about what it was like and what happened and what it's like today in regards to my own tragedy that I walked through in sobriety. And what it was like is, you know, I came out of my rehab. I went to the nearest Serenity Club in Corona. And I went and I was looking for young people in Alcoholics Anonymous because I wanted to have some fun in sobriety. And I didn't want to go back to the miserable life I had before. So I got there and I went Thursdays at 7:30. And it was just a bunch of young people. My age, a little older, a little younger, it didn't matter. And they were having fun and they were doing the deal. And I thought, wow, how cool is that? How awesome is that? So I kept going. Sure enough, I started talking to people. I met awesome people. I met a lot of good people, and one among them in specific, I met a gentleman named Andrew Knight. And this guy, if I could describe him in two words, it would be best friend. And then I'd add an ever. You know, he was funny, he was caring, he was loving. He would call you on your lies, on your BS, but he would do it in a fashion where he'd say, you know what, I care, but this is very sick. You need to talk to your sponsor, you know. He was a little chunky dude. He liked white tees and Nike Cortezes, high white socks, big black jackets, but he was loving and caring to the core. He liked to have fun. Immediately, you know, I clicked with him and I connected with him because he showed me love, being an alcoholic, never fitting in, that I never found before. And I connected with that group immediately. And, you know, we started hanging out. We went to meetings. We went to events. We stayed out, went to Denny's late. We would eat, you know, some energy drinks, some cigarettes. But it was all good, clean, sober, fun. And above all that, we were working our steps. We were doing the deal and having fun. So fast forward a little bit, it was 2010 in March, and we were going out to a meeting and an event out in the desert. And I hadn't seen him for a while. He moved a little further away. So I picked up my friend Joaquin, picked him up, came back from San Bernardino back to Corona in my little Scion XD, little car. And we were just talking, just catching up. Finally showed up to his house and picked him up. And man, it was like the first time all over again. You know, he had a Monster in one hand and a cigarette in the other hand and his jacket thrown over his shoulder. What's going on, dude? Where are we going tonight? Hey, we're going to the desert. Let's roll. Yeah, let's do it. And sure enough, we get in the car. We cruise out, pick up another close friend of ours. And after that, it was going to Moreno Valley to pick up the newcomer. You know, have to be a service. So off we were. We had a long, long lost drive finding her. Eventually, we found her. And this particular Saturday, I think it was Saturday, yeah, was a little overcast, little wet. And, you know, off we were on the 215 going north, junction into the 60 going east. And there it was, all of us, playing music, talking, having fun, joking around. And what happened was the car started to veer to the left on the turn. The car veered and my back tire, I was driving, my back tire hit the curb. It was a little curb, no more than half an inch high, no more than 6 inches high, and no more than 6 inches wide. And that tire hit, and after that, I lost total control. And there was a brief moment where that car was totally still. We were airborne, and that car was totally still. And I didn't know what had happened at the time. All I knew was, I'm going left, and I'm going right, and nothing's happening. And after that brief moment of silence and stillborn air, a loud crash hit my side, and then we continued to roll. And we rolled, and we finally came to a stop. Thank God we didn't hit the actual freeway. We were still on the on-ramp. We stopped, and people stopped behind us. But we rolled, and it was three rolls, and we were back on our wheels. My passenger side was concaved in. My hubcaps were all over the freeway. Pieces were missing of the car. And I still couldn't believe what happened. I still didn't want to believe what happened. I was like, what the hell just happened? You know, what's going on? I look to my right. My friend Joaquin says, are you okay? Yeah, I'm okay. Are you okay? Yeah, Victor, I'm okay. Are you girls okay? Yeah, everyone's okay. Everyone's okay. Everyone's okay. And one of our friends says, she says, oh my God, where's Andrew? He wasn't in the car. And we didn't know exactly where he was. So we hopped out of the car via the window, one by one, careful not to hit any glass. We look around, and sure enough, we see him a little bit up ahead on the freeway, laying face down. No major injuries that we saw. Minor bruises on his shoulders, minor bruise on his head. We didn't know what had happened. And people were already pulled over. They were already calling, you know, the paramedics and 911 and the fire department. And we had a nurse there. And we had a respiratory therapist. And we had someone else who knew kind of what to do. But none of us knew exactly what to do. And nobody did anything other than call the cops, call the paramedics, and wait there and say, don't move them, because if you move them, something worse could happen. We didn't know. Sure enough, quickly, you know, first people to get there was the fire department. Next was the paramedics. They checked us all out. They loaded him to a gurney. Off he was. Next came the cops. Cops were there, and they were just, you know, they're just asking us questions. What happened? Getting a report. Of course, we all, you know, were told them what had happened. And, two more friends went to the hospital, but the thing is, no one else walked out of that car with more than a scratch. No one else walked out of that car with more than a little scratch on their arm and maybe a little soreness and a bump on their head. We walked out of it completely fine. Nothing hurt. So two more friends were off to the hospital just in case, and they left. And I was sitting there. People were leaving. It was me and this newcomer girl. And I had no idea what to do, and I was totally numb, and I was totally in shock. Her parents came and picked her up, and I was loading my stuff out of the car, thinking, I guess I'll walk home. I have no idea what to do. Sure enough, she put her hand out. She said, do you want a ride? Where can we take you? I said, yes, please take me home. And I walked into my house. The drive was very quiet. I walked into my house. And still numb. And the only thought in my mind was a very sick one. And it was, you know, a drink sounds really good right now. And watching a scary movie sounds good right now. Because I don't know what the fuck to do. And this can't be happening. I need to live in some fantasy world because I can't deal with what's going on right now. And I'm completely, absolutely powerless. And I can't do anything. Great. My worst feeling ever. So I went up to my room and I was sitting there and I was contemplating the idea and I was trying to get it all right because I'm a very ritualistic person, don't you know? So I was sitting there and I got a phone call and you know, it was with a friend that was, she went to the ambulance and she gave me a call and she said, you need to get all of Andrew's stuff and you need to find out who to contact. You need to contact his parents. You need to get down to the hospital. He needs to contact his sister and anybody else, any numbers. They need to find his ID and all sorts of stuff. And I had his backpack. So I'm calling all over town looking for a ride. I get one from the person I last suspected would give me a ride. Someone who, she wasn't really too involved, but sure enough, she responded to the call. And off we were to Moreno Valley. And when I got there, it was a bittersweet moment. Because, you know, my friends are in the hospital and I don't know what's going on. And the only part that was slightly sweet was that the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous was there, full throttle. There was people there from Long Beach, people there from San Diego. There was people there all over the Inland Empire. There was people there that don't really show up to anything, but for some reason this night they were there. They were there and they cared. People I didn't even know were there. And they were giving us hugs. And they're asking if there was anything that they could do for us. We kept going and we were walking back and forth and we'd be praying and we were gonna go look for him. We were gonna go see how he was doing. We got his parents down there and we got his stepsister down there. And as we were going to walk in to see him, his parents walked out and said he had passed. And right about then, it was horrible, like feeling of emptiness and thinking like, how did this happen? We were doing the right thing. Like we were going to an event, we were all sober, we were helping a newcomer, and how did this happen? How? I just wanted to run. I don't know where I was going to go, but I just wanted to run laps to avoid this pain, but they wouldn't let me. You know, they gave me hugs, and they held me, and they said, we're going over here. We're going to Norco now. You know, after a while, we're going to Norco. I don't know what we're going to do there, but we're going to be there. We're going to fellowship, and we went there. You know, fast forward a little bit. I went home, and what I fell into was a numbness. Fast forward a little bit more, you know, for the next 3-4 months, I think, I tried to avoid with sex, and I tried to avoid by not accepting it. And I didn't eat very much, but the one thing that sure enough never failed was I always went to a meeting every day. And a person from my close area called every day, and that was big for me, because without them I don't know what I would have done. We began to talk about it a little bit on a one-on-one basis. We began to continue to do meetings. We began to honor him. That was what it was like and what happened. What it's like today is it's very simple for me. I'm not the only one going through it. I'm not the only one who's going to go through it. And I'm not the only one who went through it. And what that means is someone's gone through it that has the experience to help me through what I'm going through. Someone also is going through the same pain. I might be going through that same moment. And you know what? I'm not the last one to go through this pain. Today I visit his son. He had a son. I visit him every Christmas and every chance that I get on Ridgecrest. You know, I honor his grave. I visit my friend's grave. And, you know, it's been a journey. But we didn't drink. And I think that's very important. We went through a huge tragedy, that close area of mine. No one drank. We walked through things in sobriety. And that's something I learned on very early, but I didn't understand it. I just heard it in one ear and out the other, and it made sense for once. We don't drink no matter what, because it does us no good. Today, life is good. Not everything makes a whole lot of sense, but that's okay. They told me more will be revealed. I believe them. More has been revealed. And I hope it continues to be revealed. With that, if you're going through anything, reach out. If you've gone through something, reach out. That is my encouragement. I don't know. It's nice to be here. And I thank you all for being here and having me on this panel. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Victor. Our third speaker is Tara from Phoenix. So please welcome her.
Hi, I'm Tara. I'm an alcoholic. Wow. I'm really honored and I'm extremely grateful that you asked me to be on this panel. To my fellow panelists, you know, it takes a lot of strength and a lot of courage to come up here and reveal that and show something that's very hard, and I just respect you both very much for coming up here and showing me and everyone else that it's okay to cry and it's okay to feel, because I'm not that person most of the time. I will probably try and make this light and airy, but be honest at the same time. I have a sponsor. I have a home group. My sobriety date is April 9th of 2003. I got sober a month before my 15th birthday. I got sober out in Phoenix, Arizona. Just a little about why I'm on this panel and what happened, what it was like. I guess I'll start off with why I went to a rehab facility and I was in a halfway house. And I remember there was this girl that was in my halfway house that I was in treatment with. And I remember she had about, you know, it was she her father had passed away about 4 months prior to her coming to the treatment center. And I remember she was one of my roommates that was in my room. And I remember she cried a lot, and she was very upset, and I tried to be there for her in any way possible that I could be. But I remember thinking to myself, fuck, that sucks. If that happened to me, I would definitely not be in rehab right now. I would be getting loaded. props to you. You know, when I got out of that rehab, and I stayed sober, and I continued to show up to meetings, and I continued to do what I was told, and I started working the steps, and things got really better. You know, I started to feel really good. I had about 4 months sober. Shit was going well. I used to drink and use with my dad frequently, and we were kind of like running partners, and I was kind of on the fence at this time in my sobriety. I had about 4 months sober. I kind of was feeling like, I don't know, I'm starting to feel pretty great. Like, maybe I can go out and drink again. That seems like a pretty good idea. And what happened around that time, I was starting to feel that way and whatever. And I decided through my sponsor and through other people that maybe it wouldn't be the best time to speak with my dad and try and hang out with him, because I knew I'd probably drink and use if I did. And I had 4 months sober, and on my 4 months sober, my father passed away. And I was at a friend's house, and we were all sober, and we actually all had lice. That's the part of the story that I hate telling. But I had freaking lice. And it sucked so bad. Horrible. You're like a 15-year-old girl and you have lice. It's like the worst thing ever. You're just like so embarrassed. So we were contaminated at this girl's house because we all had lice. I told you I was probably trying to make it a little bit airy and light. And and my mom came over. My mom called me. It was around 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I was, of course, sleeping all day because that's what girls do when you're 15 and you have 4 months sober. And I had been sleeping all day, and my mom gave me a call, and she was like, I'm going to come over. And I was like, that's weird. All right, come over. I have lice. That sucks for you if you get it. That's fine. And my mom came over, and I had this, like, weird feeling, right? This, like, really weird, like, what's going on? Like, my mom never usually comes over. Like, this is really weird. And I was like, my dog definitely died. My poor, awesome Rottweiler probably died. Oh, my God, it's totally it. I'm going to freak out. And she came over and she pulled me into the girls' room, and she told me that my father had passed away and that they found him dead in his trailer, and that he had been dead for the past 3 days. And I fell and I cried. And the first place they took me and all the girls that had lice, they took us to our treatment facility that they were in. And I just cried, and I was really numb, and really scared, and really upset. And I had not talked to my dad for a month, and I had blamed myself. And I went to the treatment facility and sat there all night and bawled my eyes out. And I just remember sitting there, and my counselor at the time saying, I was like, I don't know how I'm going to make it through this. Like, I don't know how I'm not going to drink. And the one thing, I really don't remember much of anything that anyone said to me through this, but the one thing he said to me was that there's nothing that drinking won't make worse. And I thought to myself in that moment that there was just absolutely no way that I could, that I wanted to make this any worse than it already was. And so I continued to show up. I really, honestly, what really happened to me was I went into a really crazy place. I cried for about 3 days. I was very upset. I don't really remember a whole lot of what happened after that night, but I was upset, and then I went to a place called Terrorland, and was in total oblivion to what you were doing or what was happening around me. I have 3 memories in a 9-month period of time. I don't remember what happened. I have friends that I was sober with at the time, or that I'm still friends with now, that'll say, oh, do you remember when we were really sober and we did this, that, and the other? And I'll be like, no, I don't remember saying that. I don't remember doing that. I don't remember being there. I really don't remember a thing besides 3 things. And I'm not going to tell you what those 3 things are because I'm being recorded right now and they're really horrible. But I went really crazy. I went really, really crazy.
And I really would just do things all the time. I went into a weird place, and I just felt like whether I'm sober or whether I'm getting loaded, I'm going to die, and I'm going to die. It's going to happen. So I felt like I needed to reach this higher plane of life. So I would like tap my wrist while like circling my finger while saying elephant, while thinking of an umbrella, while saying clock, while spinning clockwise, while, and at that time, at that moment, no one has ever done those exact things. So therefore I've like reached this higher plateau of life, right? And so I'm better than you. So I've infused life, and now like I'm on this plateau. And it was crazy. So for like about a year of my life, I completely just did that constantly to escape the pain, to escape the reality, to escape any type of me having to look at how this is going to affect me or how I'm feeling. I don't remember, I think the reason why I don't really have very many memories is because I don't remember having any feelings. I don't remember feeling sad. I don't remember feeling happy. I don't remember feeling anything. And I had about, this went on for about a year, and, you know, I had pushed a lot of people away because I was in Terrorland all the time, and, in a really weird state of mind, and, I got a year sober, and I decided to completely throw myself into this program, and I started sponsoring people, and I started, going to more meetings, and I started really diving into my steps and doing a four-step. And just really being involved in this thing and helping another alcoholic and caring. And I started to get some feelings back, and I started to feel okay. And I started to feel like maybe I didn't have to defend myself or like build this really high wall up. And I slowly but surely started to have some feelings again and started to get close relationships. For a really long time, I pushed a lot of people away because I was very scared of having relationships. And I was really okay with people leaving, which is kind of a weird effect to have. But that's what happened to me, and that's my experience, is that I just really expected you to leave. And when you didn't, I just pushed you away because I just really didn't want to get close at all. So I had about a year and a half sober, and I was like 16, I'm like doing good and sponsoring people, I'm like shit was getting better, and I got a job, which was awesome, and I got fired because I worked at Paradise Bakery, and I got fired because I would literally duck behind the counter and stuff a muffin in my face and eat it, and then get the next person in line, and they fired me for not paying for my food. That's really embarrassing, just because I ate all their food and didn't pay for it. I probably still owe them amends, kind of thing about it. I got fired, you know, whatever. And I was getting jobs, and it was cool, and I had money, and I always had a really horrible relationship with my mom, and I started to form kind of like a cool relationship with my mom where I was sober. I wouldn't freak out on her all the time. I mean, I would still, but not all the time. You know, my life started to get a little bit better. I started to feel like, all right, cool. Like, I'm all right. I'm, like, getting to a good place. Like, you know, whatever. I formed a really awesome relationship with my higher power. I just really, really relied on a higher power with every single step and motion of my day. Obviously not with eating the food. There's just some things you don't really catch on to, maybe when you're in early sobriety, or just in general, maybe, because some things I still don't catch on to. I started to feel all right, and I started to feel really great. And my mom wasn't feeling well, and she had like fallen down at my grandfather's house one night when she stayed there, and she wasn't feeling good, and she started to get these really bad headaches, and she went to the doctor, and they found out that she had lung cancer. And she told me, you know, she got CAT scans and all that, and me and my grandpa went up to the hospital, and she told us both that she had cancer. She was, like, super excited about it, which was really weird. I mean, that's what really threw me off. She was, like, really pumped, you know, to fight the cancer and all this stuff. And I just remember thinking, like, what the fuck? Like, I just got dealt the shittiest cards ever, you know? Like, I just felt like it just wasn't going to end. Like, I just kept on getting dealt twos when everyone else was getting dealt kings,
you know, and all my friends and that I got sober with just kept on, like, progressing, and their lives were getting awesome, and, like, cool shit was happening. And I was like, really? Again? Like, this is for real? And I decided to just really just try and be the best daughter I could possibly be at all moments. I started to, you know, just really have a really great relationship with my mom, and she became my best friend, my absolute best friend. I would be excited to leave you guys to hang out with my mom, and I did it on a frequent occasion. I would take my mom out to eat with money that I had from, I don't know, like some weird little hostess job I had or whatever. And I'd save my money up, my tips up all week so I could take her to, like, Denny's and take her out and, you know, be cool. And, you know, I had a really hard time. I was 16 and a half, and I took my mom to her chemo appointments, and I drove her around, and I helped her out, and I took care of my mom for a year and a half. And I got really close with her, and I got the chance to be a really great daughter and to make a really awesome, amazing living amends and to say everything I ever wanted to say to her. Everything I ever wanted to say to her. And, you know, it started to progressively get worse, and we had to put her in a home. And, you know, through this, I was so terrified because I was not even 18 yet, and I had no fucking clue what I was going to do, and I didn't know how to pay bills, and I didn't know how to, like, the weird dryer thing where it, like, beeps because the lint's full, and you're like, why is it beeping? And you, like, freak out. I, like, didn't know that existed. And, like, I didn't know what to do, you know what I mean? And I was young, and I didn't know what SRP was. Like, I thought that was, like, a brand of, like, toast, you know, or, like, bread, or I don't know what I thought it was. I thought it was, like, the weird, like, Wonder Bread, whatever. You know, I just didn't know, and I was so terrified, and I just kept showing up. People just told me just to keep showing up. And I just kept showing up, and I just kept opening my mouth, and I just kept talking. And even when I thought you guys were like, shut up already, you know, and not that people were, but, like, that was one of the things that I got, is that, like, I need to be strong, I need to muscle through this, I need to figure it out, I need to be there, I need to be the strong one. And then my friends allowed me to not have to be that way, and to just fall apart, you know, and to be strong when I was in front of my mom, and to help her in any way I could, but just to fall apart in front of them, and that's what you people did for me. And I, a month after my 18th birthday, I was in this rehab, and we all went to this California trip. And I had went to visit my my mom in the facility that she was in, the nursing care place that she was in. And she was really bad, and she couldn't talk anymore. And she was on, you know, a breathing apparatus. And I went to go see her, and I before we drove to California. And I told her I loved her, and she couldn't say anything to me. And before I walked out the room, she said, I love you, Tara, goodbye. My mom never said that to me. And I got into the car with one of my really good friends that I was sober with, and I told her I really hope that my mom dies. And I really didn't want to say that out loud because I thought that that sounded really horrible, and it still does sound kind of horrible. But I really did. I really didn't want to see her in pain any longer. And so we went to California, and the first night that we were there, I got home. We had gone to the beach, and I came home, and I got a phone call, and it was from the lady that ran the facility, and she told me that my mom had passed away. And I thanked her for calling me calmly on the phone. She was really freaked out about that. And I fell on the floor and hysterically started to bawl. And one of my really good friends was there, and he helped me and, you know, just let me cry and let me be where I was at. And I sat in the room for 3 hours, and everyone that was at the California trip came into the room and held me and talked to me, and I wouldn't open my eyes the entire time because what I was really afraid of is how you guys were going to look at me. That's what I was really afraid of. I was terrified of getting that look of sadness for me. Because, I don't know why. Because I felt like I would lose it. not that I wasn't already. And I talked to people, and I cried, and we went out to dinner, and I don't really remember it. I kind of do. But I remember kind of just being able to cry and let it out and feel. But it was, I went out that night, and I prayed, and I, you know, asked God to be with me. And I told God that I wasn't mad, and that I wasn't going to separate me from him, and that I understood, because I knew eventually I would be like, screw you, God. But right after it happened, I said, God, I want you to stay with me, you know, and I'm not mad, and I want to continue to be, you know, have a relationship with you, and, you know, and I did. And I went back home, and I sold my house, and I moved out on my own into an apartment. And it was really hard, and you people showed up for me, and you people told me what SRP actually was, and how to pay a bill, and how to turn the gas and water on, and how to get the little lint stuff out of the dryer, and do the whole thing, you know, and I really, truly, you guys really saved my life. And, you know, it's been a really, it's been an experience at this point. Yeah, I can look back on it with gratitude. I have absolutely no regrets with my mom. I felt like I'm really grateful that I was able to be sober and show up for her. And I've worked through a lot of things with my dad, and I'm grateful that I got to watch someone that close to me and see what would have happened to me. I feel like that was a huge part of my sobriety. And, you know, I guess that there's been a lot of things that have come up over the years. You know, I feel like it's always peeling back the layer of an onion. There's times where I'm an emotional wreck. There's times where I'm fine. It's come out in really weird ways. I'm emotionally unavailable. Batshit crazy. You know, it's come out in a lot of different ways. I've had a lot of like really weird fears. Not weird, I mean, they're whatever, but I've had a lot of fears. I'm terrified of Christmas and Thanksgiving. And this is actually going to be the first year that I am actually single and haven't taken anyone hostage this year. Watch out. Just kidding. I'm kidding. This is the first time I will not have a boyfriend for Thanksgiving and Christmas. I mean, I don't think, but as of right now. That's so weird. I've taken people hostage because I've absolutely got, one of the weird ways it's come out is I've gotten into relationships because I'm terrified of Christmas and Thanksgiving with people I didn't really necessarily like. Because I was scared of the holidays. And that's how the fear has controlled my life. You know, and I've done this past year and a half, I've worked a lot around this subject, and I've been really close to the higher power, and I've been meditating a lot more. And I've just been able to be me, and that's what's really great, is because I felt like for such a long time I had so many walls built up, like really apparent, very apparent walls. And to the point where people were like, dude, I can't hang out with you. Like, you're so emotionally shut off and gone. And it's really great because I actually can feel now. And not a lot, obviously. You know what I mean? But a little bit, which is really good for me. And I'm really grateful for that. And I'm just really grateful to be here, and I'm really honored to be on a panel with you guys. You guys just show me so much strength. I was like, oh my God, they're like showing their emotions. That's so great. I hope that I can get there. So yeah, that's it. I'll pass. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to have, let me see what we have coming up now. Rob with the Third Step Promises.